Hey there, I just got back from my workout. I did weights today and I'll be running tomorrow. Yeah. I'm Damon Janis, founder of Eyes on Investors, part of Lifestyles Unlimited, which is the mentoring group for real estate investors. And my guest in this interview is Michael Zuber. He's a successful real estate investor in California. Now, a lot of people think that real estate investment doesn't work in crazy markets like California or Phoenix or New York, but Mike proves that that's just wrong. In this interview, he explains his model and how to take your model and adapt it to the market and not try to force your model into the market. So this was a really fun interview with Mike, and I think that you're going to enjoy it. Yeah, so how did you hear about us?
Just trolling the web.
Really?
Just looking for more and more. Yeah, always reading, always looking for the next thing. So I probably watched 40, 50 hours of your guys' podcasts or radio shows.
The radio shows.
Yeah. Read as much as I can. Love what Dale and Steve are doing. So
yeah.
Figured it's time for me to give back a little.
Well, that's great. Well, I appreciate it. I was so happy to see when you reached out and were willing to do this. And then when we talked last time, found out you were from Mountain View, which is my old stomping grounds. That's so cool.
Yeah, Mountain View's a pretty small place. Went to high school at St. Francis. So.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yep. Right there on Miramonte.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So do you know Springer Elementary School?
I do.
I think it's still there, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah, that's where I went to grade school there. So
I am probably sitting right now 4 miles from Springer, the way the crow flies.
Really? Okay.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, that's so cool. Yeah, I was thinking the house my parents that we lived in when I was little, they brought it brand new. I think it was 1970. It's on Lime Tree Lane, which is just south of Springer there.
Yep.
And it's like a three-bedroom, two-bath, maybe 1,300-1,400 square feet. I think they paid $16,000 or $20,000 is what I remember for that thing.
It's worth, even in this market, over $1 million.
Exactly, exactly. I looked it up a couple of years ago, and it was, at the time, I think it was like $1.6 million. I'm thinking, my goodness. So
nothing like it.
Nothing like it. Well, and that's why I'm so happy to talk to you, because I know a lot of people think there's no way you can invest in a state like California, and yet you've got about 20 properties or so, don't you, right now?
We own 120 doors.
For 120 doors.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, we started 10 years ago, and we bought just houses and a couple of duplexes. We let the first, the wave, 2001 was a good time to buy, 2006 was a good time to sell. We sold all that and bought apartment buildings, and we're sitting tight. And, lately we've been buying the distressed houses again. So we're buying what I call the greenhouses again.
Okay, and that you mentioned you've got about 20 of those, is that right?
Yeah, 20 of them done already, and, got, five or six in the works already. So always active. You just got to keep buying in this market.
Yeah, because that's what I'm seeing. I mean, of course, I'm in Houston, and the market's... Mm-hmm. I'll find out more as we talk, what the similarities are, but it sounds like there must be some similarities because it's a good time to be buying here too.
Yeah.
So, well, I'm thinking this started off great. Let's just keep talking and we'll make this the interview. How's that?
Works for me.
All right.
What do you want to do?
Yeah, let's do that. I'm really curious. I think the biggest thing I'm curious about is how are you finding properties in your market? Mm-hmm. Where you're able to actually make a profit, like can they cash flow? Because the perception is that even though property values have come down in California, they're still expensive and you can't get the rents, for what you're paying and all that sort of thing. So how do you do it?
Well, first off, it starts a little bit with the market you select, right? California is a very large state. I live, obviously, in a very expensive part of the world in Mountain View, California. But we invest in Fresno and Madera, which is about 2.5 to 3 hours drive from where we live. So first and foremost, it's where you choose to invest, right? Live where you want, invest where the money makes sense.
Right.
So we invest there. And we've been investing there for 10 years, so we know the market cold, we know lots of agents. Okay. But it really takes, it really takes work. I mean, that's one of the things that I like to tell new investors is it takes work. It's not, hey, I went online, or hey, I looked in the newspaper or whatever and I found five properties and I found the one of the five that's the best and I made an offer. No, I look at hundreds of properties every day, and there's probably three or four that are even close to making sense. So it takes a lot of work. It takes talking with agents, making relationships with agents so that they call you. And it takes you know, making shots. I probably make, even today, 20 offers for every 3 or 4 that get a decent counter, and, you know, maybe I put 1 or 2 in escrow.
Okay.
One of the things I try to do is everything I get in escrow, I close, because I'm trying to keep my relationship with the agents.
Yeah.
So that's pretty important to me. You know, I never want to burn an agent like that. That way they call me when they have a property that falls out of escrow.
Okay.
Right. So, you know, that's really where I find a lot of my best deals is on properties that are quote-unquote distressed. So in my market, that means doesn't qualify for FHA. And then, you know, if it falls out of escrow a time or two, the agents get a little annoyed, and then they start calling people they know that can close. So,
okay.
You know, I've built up a reputation, I hope, that I value, that I close deals. So I'd say at least half my deals come that way. The other half is calling off first-day listings and just taking my shots. It takes work, but there's always new inventory.
I mean, yeah.
It does seem to come in waves. I mean, 6 months ago, it was a really slow trickle. I would tell you, at least again, in my market, there's probably 15 or 20 solid new listings a day. That dreaded shadow inventory maybe is starting to release a little bit.
When you say 16 properties, are you saying these are 16 properties that might be potential investments, or that's in the entire market area?
No, those would be in my show up in my screen, right?
Your filter criteria, what your box is, they're showing up in your box.
Yeah, I'm sure there's hundreds of new ones, but I don't invest in.
You're just looking at the ones that are going to work for your model.
Exactly.
Okay.
And again, my model's pretty tight. It's refined. You know, 10 years ago it was, hey, you know, the famous 1% rule. Today I don't look at anything that doesn't have a cash on cash or what I call yield of 20%.
Okay.
Right. And given I have a lot of property, the 20% means my down payment, which in this market's 50% for me. So I have a hard money guy that'll take the other 50%. Then it's the closing costs, which is about $2,500, and then all my make-ready costs.
Okay.
And then expected cash flow divided by my all out-of-pocket. You know, if it's not 20% or greater, I won't even look at the deal.
And you're talking about 20% cash-on-cash return, not capital gains, right?
No, cash-on-cash. Capital gains means nothing in the model that I'm using today. I mean, it's a nice thing to do in 5 or 8 or 10 years when I take all these greenhouses and, you know, create some more red hotels, but...
Right.
It's about buying greenhouses today.
So right now you're focusing on cash flow way down the road. Eventually you'll sell them or do whatever, and then you'll take that capital and go back into apartments when that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, in fairness, I do look at everything. You know, I mean, just like Dell talks about, I do look at apartments. I do look at, the 5 to 40 unit buildings to see if there's anything distressed there.
Right.
But if it doesn't hit my 20% return, I don't bother. Mm-hmm. You know, I've made a couple of offers on some 5s and 8s, but... You know, right now the stress isn't there. The blood in the streets in the single-family homes and the duplexes. So that's why, that's why I do the deals today.
Focusing on that. So when you put an offer in, are you typically, I guess there's two scenarios I want to ask you this question. You said about half of the properties are coming from agents that the property fell out of escrow, it didn't close for some reason. They're trying to find a solid buyer. The other scenario was the first day it comes up on the MLS, You're getting in there. So let's take the first scenario. When an agent calls you and says, you know, Mike, I got a property, fell out of escrow, you know, are you interested in buying it? Are you typically offering less than what the deal was going to be?
I would tell you of the 20 deals that I've closed just in this last 18 months, I can only think of one I paid list price for.
Okay.
I would tell you my average is 20 to 25% under list.
Okay.
The one I did pay list was a first day listing, 2 houses, one big city lot, that I thought was just priced where I would have bought it anyway.
I see.
So, I mean, they had, and in that story, they called me the next day and said they had offers of 25 to 30K over list price. So, I pulled the trigger fast and got that one.
But I see.
Yeah, I don't pay list price. You don't have to in this market. My boy.
Right.
And I don't get in bidding wars either.
Uh-huh.
Right. On the first day listings, I tell the agents up front that, you know, if you know, typically if when I send my offer and this is my number, I'll come up a little bit just to, you know, to bend up, you know, 500 to $1,000. But
yeah.
If there's 10 offers, I don't even bother. I say, call me when it falls out.
Okay.
You know, my model just won't support it.
Yeah. And you probably don't want to spend time making a bunch of offers if it's just not going to happen. So
exactly. My time is more valuable.
Right. Okay. So 20 to 25% generally below what they're asking for, and that's both in both scenarios, both when an agent brings it to you as well as the MLS?
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, it's just my general starting point. And again, sure, if the number doesn't make sense in the MLS, I have gone lower. I've gone as low as half off the MLS, but that's because I know that there's something unique that I don't think was priced in. Hmm. You know, for example, it just gotten broken into, or, you know, there was a mold problem in one of the bathrooms, or, you know, whatever. Something that I think justifies it. I will give the agent that information just so you don't, so I don't seem like just some sleazebag guy who makes 100 offers on everything.
Sure. Yeah.
I say, I'm giving you this, and this is why. You may not know that it just got broken into and is now tagged in every bedroom and this thing.
Right. So. Okay, cool. So on the financing side, you mentioned you have a hard money lender that you've partnered with. Is that right?
Yeah, so financing is the hardest thing, you know, as you know, for an active investor these days. So, mm-hmm. You know, and again, my model's pretty rigid right now. So I find distressed assets. I have to come in with 50% of my own capital. I have a hard money guy that takes the other half.
Okay.
He charges me 9%, 10-year fixed. Actually, now it's 15 years fully amortized, we agreed on. Okay. So he's deep pocket, so that's taken care of. But again, he only does 50% of whatever the agreed purchase price on. Most of the stuff I get appraises for double, even in the condition I'm buying them at. But he only gives me 50 points off purchase, which is fine. That's the agreement we have.
So you're coming up with the other 50%?
Absolutely. So. Coming up with the other 50. I'm coming up with all closing costs, and I'm coming up with all the make ready.
So your cash in is actually greater than your lender's cash in.
Absolutely. Okay. Yeah, his security is well in hand. He hopes I wake up and don't pay him.
You've got more skin in the game than he does.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's really why my model has evolved, if you've looked at the site. Because what I'll do is after I go get it, make ready, right, I've got a bunch of cash in, I go get it leased, and now it's just cash flowing like crazy. Because unlike prices, which have come way down, the rents in my market are stable. They may have fluctuated $25 lower in my apartments, but all my houses are the same.
I see.
So my rents are flat, but prices are 20% what they used to be, so, you know, the yields are great. So that's when I go back to my private investors, or sometimes even banks will do portfolio loans for you, and I go and try to find a private money investor that will, you know, come in for 10 or 12% for, you know, 10, 15, 20 grand increments.
Right.
And that's how I get some, if not all, my capital back. So I can take that greenhouse, it's now functioning, it's, you know, got very little of my own personal equity in it or capital, and I'm off buying the next one.
Okay.
Right. So private investors like it because they're, you know, they get a healthy return, but most importantly, it's because their money is tied to a functioning asset. A lot of the investors, because, you know, I've been in the game a long time, they're asking for private money on distressed stuff, right? Give me the, you know, give me 50 grand plus, you know, fix up a hey-ho, I promise, you know, it'll be great. No, my stuff's leased. It's already repaired. There's no issues with it. You know, without your loan, the cash flow is $700 a month. With your loan, the cash flow is $500 a month. So, again, you probably hope I don't pay you. That's sort of my running joke with my private investors is, you know, the deal should be good enough where you hope I don't pay you.
Right.
Otherwise, you know, I'm not going to do it. So
right.
That's what I'm trying to do.
That's cool. So let me ask you this. How do you establish relationships with – I mean, so far we've talked about you've got a hard money guy you partner with,
yep,
you private investors, real estate agents that are bringing you deals. How are you establishing relationships and cultivating that with these different people so that they work?
Yeah, so it takes time, right? It's not something that you wake up with a Rolodex. You know, it comes from being in the market for 10 years and telling people you're in real estate. You know, over time, I've made relationships, again, my market with some writers at the Fresno Bee, as an example. You know, again, just the more contacts you can make, the more agents. I go to the Fresno REI events, even though it's 3 hours away and held on a weekday, so more people out there know me. I write you know, I try to share as much information I can, much like Lifestyles, Dell, and Steve do. So I actually write up my reports and just give free access to stuff, not selling anything. So if people want to see what I'm doing, they can.
Yeah.
You know, we the wife and I answer any and all questions that come to us from friends. And, you know, after a while, you know, the network and the beehive expands. And, you know, once people start to see the returns and the security, they tell other friends and, you know, it sort of goes from there.
So you establish your credibility, and that sounds like a big component of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, my model doesn't work unless I put skin in the game, right? With
right.
These 20 houses, you know, we deployed, I don't know, conservatively $300,000 or $400,000 to get them, secure them before we did you know, before we started going out to private investors, right? That right. experience relationships, you can walk through them, see the leases, you know, they're all legit things. So, yeah. you know, it's not a model that everybody can do, but it's certainly the model that has worked for us.
And it works in that area too, where, you know, what I'm seeing is different, you know, different locations have different ways that you need to do it. And so an investor needs to have some flexibility and insight into, well, this is, you know, if I target this, you can get it working. I want to kind of tie that into, you talked about having a rigid model, and I want to understand and help people that are listening. Why don't you just try a whole bunch of stuff? Why do you just have a rigid model that you focus on?
Well, so that's a very, very good question. So I tell every investor they have to have, you know, one sort of driving criteria or goal. And it can't be something loosey-goosey like I want a net worth of $1 million or, you know, just something sort of out there, because the shotgun approach really doesn't work. So my goal is 20% return on any cash I put out or greater.
Okay.
And this is, you know, that's, you know, if the deal doesn't hit that, I don't consider it, right? I don't care if it's a McMansion. I still get calls on. I probably get a call once a month from an agent that I know that says, Mike, I've got the perfect flip house for you. I go, what part of our conversation over the last 4 years makes you think I want to flip a freaking house? You know, not my thing, you know. Right. It sounds like another job to me. It's just not where I want to go. So, you know, it's about not being distracted, because when you get distracted, or you go, you know what, or even worse, get bored, that's when you make mistakes that cost you lots of money and whatever you've built can explode. So I have a rigid model. I follow it on purpose, and when it stops working, I will adjust. You know, but I already have a plan for that, because when I can stop buying these houses, I'll sit back for a little while, let them get back to near replacement costs, and I'll sell, you know, which I hope by the time is 50 or 100 greenhouses, and, you know, buy some nice red hotels and be absolutely done.
Yeah, well, that's awesome. Well, and you've been doing this for a while, so I think now would be a good time. I'd like to go back to kind of the beginning of when you got started in real estate investing. What was your motivation, and how did you get started?
Yeah, so rewind the clock, 2001. Anybody remember what happened in 2001?
Yeah, traumatic year.
Yeah, traumatic year. So, again, I live in the Valley. I work at a high-tech company. So does the wife. You know, we thought we'd figured out the stock market game. You know, we did the whole day trading thing. Worked great for a while. Didn't work great for long. So we realized we had to do something else. It just was not the way to go. So real estate, you know, became the option. We spent a year looking in the Bay Area for anything that remotely made sense. Yeah. And it was actually through a contact of my wife that we were introduced to the Central Valley, which ultimately became Fresno and Madera, created some initial relationships out there with some friends of friends. And, you know, we took a trip down there on a Saturday and were shown one house. You know, the guy we were with owned, I think he owned 60 or 70 houses at the time. And he only could show us one, because 2001 was a very different real estate market. It was just on the uptick. And we weren't sophisticated. It was the 1% rule, right? It was going to rent for $1,100. We can buy it for $107. You know, that was it. We bought it. And, you know, that was the beginning, right? I think it cash flowed in Excel of probably $80 or $100. In reality, it never really did cash flow. Right, because you always had those repairs.
Yeah,
it was a skinny deal. It would not be something I would do today. But you asked about the beginning. That's what we did. We did a couple more houses and duplexes, and then we watched the prices just soar. 2005, 2006, Fresno was the number one market a couple of years running, like 40% of crazy appreciation. We sold all the houses. You know, that first house I talked about for $107, we sold it for $269 or $267, wow. Less than 3 years later.
Wow.
And we started moving all our capital into apartments, 5s and 10s and 13s and 18s. And we sat tight for a long time. But the other thing I strongly believe in is when you have capital and you've chosen to be a real estate investor is you don't buy toys. I've seen lots of people get in the game, have some luck, and then start peeling off some money to go buy a toy, a new car, a vacation, whatever.
Right.
Never happens in our world, right? Every dollar we've got in is in the game, right? We have, you know, that money tree we planted. We want to be something in the future. We do, you know, we do nice things, but it's from our you know, our W-2 income and ain't from real estate.
So even while you guys are doing this, do you still and your wife still, you're working for these companies and you do this real estate on the side?
Absolutely, yeah.
Interesting.
It's nice to have an income.
Yeah.
You know, because even if we didn't have private investors, we can probably still do one a month, maybe one every 6 weeks with our income and cash flow from everything else.
Uh-huh.
So yeah, we're gonna keep working. You know, we're relatively still young, and we're gonna keep working until we switch out and get to Red Hotels. But yeah. By then, I'm done.
Then you're done.
Yeah. You know, 3, 4, 5 years left at, you know, 40 and 45K houses. I mean, yeah, I'll keep working for that.
Yeah.
You know, plus, you know, it doesn't hurt that you actually like your job. So,
well, that yeah, absolutely.
I look forward to being done too.
Do you work? I'm just curious. Do you work for an IT company or for like in technology?
Yeah, I do. I work for Hewlett Packard.
Oh, do you? Okay. Yeah. See, I grew up in the Bay Area there, Silicon Valley. I thought, you know, I'll come back and work there after I have a software or a computer science degree. So I've been programming for years and years and years, but I never got back to Silicon Valley. So
come on back.
Yeah.
Rent though, houses too expensive.
It is pretty expensive. Yeah. But someday I'll be able to afford it. We're making progress in that area.
Sure you are.
So that's good. So you're still working and you're able to take all the cash flow and capital that you're getting from your real estate investing, turning it back in there, and that's accelerating your ability to be able to get this all wrapped up, you know, once you move into the red houses, I think you call them, or the apartments.
Greenhouses, red hotels, Monopoly, man.
Greenhouses, red hotels. Okay, that makes sense. I was going to ask you, what you keep talking about greenhouses. What are you talking about?
Greenhouses, red hotels. Sorry, Monopoly.
I'm totally with you now. on the apartments, then you purchased some small apartments, 10 units, 13. How do you handle the management of that? Are you doing that yourself, or are you getting other people?
We're 3 hours again, right? We're three hours from all of our investments. So we actually have a couple of property management teams, roughly split 50-50. So there's a little competition and, you know, healthy competition between the firms for our business. But yeah, we outsource that activity.
Okay. Right? And on the single family too, you outsource.
Absolutely. Yeah. Our job is twofold: find deals, secure capital.
Okay.
Right. And then, you know, we deal with the, you know, we pay the management fee, their fee, and they call us, you know. I talk to them every day. You know, we have 120 doors, so.
Well, and that frees up your time so that you can get your income from your jobs and all that, too.
I mean, it would be a full-time job just managing those. And, you know, again, live where you want, but invest where it makes sense. So
right.
That's what we're doing.
Gotcha. So when you're looking at the costs, you know, getting that 20%, you're including the fact that someone else is going to be managing all of these things.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, you know, so the upfront numbers, everything out of my pocket. So down payment, closing costs, make ready,
mm-hmm.
and then the expected cash flow is obviously rent minus, you know, the hard money loan, the mortgage payments, taxes, insurance, property management fee, repair and maintenance, vacancy. You know, all the stuff you hear about.
Yeah.
On a typical house, you know, we'll get, you know, $954 all-in expenses, you know, would be, so just property management, maintenance, vacancies, you know, right around $200.
Okay.
You know, throw in another $75 in repairs, just sort of rough and tough. Because, again, we fix them all up, you know, before somebody's in there again. So it's, you know, it shouldn't be maintenance for a while unless they break something.
Right.
And then it's mortgage payments, tax, insurance, which you would expect. So,
okay.
You know, we're cash flowing. It's right about $450 to $500 a door on a house.
That's awesome. Are the property taxes, like here in Houston, the property taxes on a little $70,000-$80,000 house can be, you know, $250 a month. So that eats into the cash flow a lot.
California is a beautiful place. I think it's 1.2-something% of purchase price.
Really?
Essentially, then there's that lovely thing you may have heard about, Prop 13, which makes it limits how far it could ratchet up.
Yeah.
So my average property tax bill is about, I'll call it $400.
Wow.
For each house a year.
A year. So it doesn't get into your cash flow much.
No, it's no. I budget, I think, $50 a month, which is high.
Okay.
It's not a bad
And on the repairs, then, does your management company find the contractors and stuff, or are you doing that to get the work?
I've established relationships now.
Okay.
With it depends on the level, right? Is it handyman kind of work, you know, paint, carpet, you know, blinds, or is it, you know, I bought a property on my site I call the Ugly House that actually had city, city code enforcement issues.
Okay.
Where I actually had to get a licensed contractor and, you know, go fill out permits and, you know, so it sort of varies.
Yeah.
But I have relationships. All the money flows through my property manager accounts.
Okay.
But yeah, you create relationships and guys you trust over the years.
So I'm actually in the middle of a rehab project right now, and I'm trying a new company that I haven't worked with before to do this house. It's like a 1,600 square foot house. It's not a real big job, but there's some good things I like about it. Some other things I don't. What do you recommend for working with the contractors so that your price is right and the job's getting done on time, it's getting done right? I mean, what's your experience there?
It sort of depends on what your end goal for the house, right? You haven't said if you want it to be a long-term rental or if it's going to be a flip. I mean, their criteria is very different,
that's
right?
That's true.
If you're flipping a house, it's all about quality, right? So you pay a little more for quality and probably pay a little bit more for speed, right? Because time is money.
Yeah.
My stuff, make ready, right? It's fix anything that's hazardous. And, typically for me, the outside's the most important, right? Because most people make rental decisions driving by the house.
Mm.
So for me, it's the white picket fence, it's the grass is mowed, it's the bushes are trimmed, and the exterior is probably painted, if not power washed, if it's okay.
Right.
So the handyman kind of make ready stuff is very different than a flip, right? And again, not a flipper, not something I do, but I have to imagine that what you want out of your contractor is very different.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. And in this case, it's going to be a long-term rental.
Okay.
I just specifically what I was thinking of when I asked the question was, I sat down the first time I met with the contractor and pulled out the sheet that I wanted to go through and say, here's a punch list. These are all the things that need to be done. And he's doing this on a fixed price for me, right? And he didn't want to fill out a sheet and do all that. So what we agreed to was that he would get the house clean and functional, ready to rent. And I kind of had to trust him on what his definition of that was going to be. And we kind of talked about it and everything, but I feel like I kind of stepped out on a limb to say, okay, look, I'll agree with you. We're not going to create the list. I'll let you manage that. But here's the result that we need to get. Jury's still out. I don't know how it's going to turn out yet.
Yeah, you know, obviously the individual is a discrete item, but that's not a bad approach. I probably would have said, I usually have a list of the four or five things that what I would consider big things. If they get missed, it's not 50 or 60 bucks to fix. It's hundreds of dollars, hundreds or thousands of dollars. So I typically would I probably wouldn't have a detailed punch list, you know, like, hey, 17 blinds and, you know, repair these two doors and whatever.
Yeah.
But I certainly would pick a couple of large items that to call it out, because it's I don't mind being out on the limb, but I want it to be a pretty sturdy limb. I would also probably have an agreement that if we go through the rental process and something comes up 30 days after you tell me you're done, you're going to come back and fix that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay.
Not a bad idea being on the limb. Just make it a little stronger next time.
Okay. Good advice. I will take your advice on that. let's see what else I have on here. So are you finding big differences between the way you do investing in apartments versus single-family houses? And does one lead to the other?
Certainly one leads to the other. I think you got to take what the market gives you. I don't think you need to overthink it. For most investors out there, it's about the yield that they can get on their capital over their time. So find out what makes the most sense in your markets. And I've tried to buy some more small apartments that have pretty sexy yields on them, but it just hasn't worked out yet. So I certainly plan to do that again. I think it's going to be, at least in my market, there's a series of waves, and I think the apartments are behind the houses, and duplexes and quads are behind the houses, and then apartments are behind the quads. So
right.
I think there's a wave coming ashore. And I'll absolutely 1031 again out of my little green houses like Monopoly into red hotels.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there is an order, and I think you got to take what the market gives you.
Yeah, that's really – I really like that. What you're saying is, if I can just kind of recap it,
mm-hmm.
is that you let the whatever the market's doing, you work with it. You don't try to enforce your own opinion or experience or whatever on it. You just you work with the market, not against it.
Let the market give you what it wants to give you, and don't fight it. Just because you think, you know, the 10-unit apartments are the best thing in the world, you know, it's probably not what the market's given today. But it may be what the market gives in 8 years. I don't know. But yeah, you know, don't overthink it. If the market, especially in a distressed state where it's a buyer's market, it's going to be telling you what's on sale.
Right.
And I like to buy what's on fire sale. So.
Right.
I like to buy stuff cheap.
Yeah, cheap is good.
Cheap is good. So it gives you a lot of margin of safety. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. The cheaper the bigger the margin, the less risk you have is really what it boils down to. Right. Now you have a website. I went and looked at it, and I can't remember the URL right offhand. What's your website?
It's wealthbuildingpro.com.
Wealthbuildingpro.com, right? And you've got some. You kind of mentioned some of the things that you're doing out there, and all. I thought it was pretty cool that you're doing that.
Thank you.
So I'd encourage our listeners to go take a look at that, and it's beneficial. Yeah.
So, you know, I took the time to write up some articles that I get, you know, questions from friends and other investors. So I took the time to write, again, one guy's opinion. So hey,
sure,
take it for what it's worth. But more importantly, I'm writing up my acquisition reports and sort of write up what I expected, what happened. You know, I grade the deal, right? A, B, C, D, just like you're in school. And I talk about lessons learned. It's shocking. Even after being in the business 10 years, every one of the acquisition reports on a little rinky-dink house has some lessons that I've even learned. So if you're not in the game, you should probably take a few minutes. And the reports are, I don't know, probably take you, I don't know, a minute to read,
yeah,
9 seconds.
They're pretty quick reads, but they're very informational, really interesting.
So that's what, you know, real estate's given me a lot. You know, I've taken advantage of folks like Dale Walmsley and Steve Davis giving out free information. So just a little way I can give back. So
yeah.
That's what
And you have. This has been a really good discussion. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you think, you know, we should talk about or that you wanted to share?
Yeah, I think there's one thing that often gets missed, because lots of people think real estate investing is the way to go. It's the investment du jour. I would tell you that one of the most important things to have is support of your significant other, whether that be a wife, a husband, a girlfriend, a, you know, a partner, whatever. If they're not on board with you, 100%, you're asking for trouble, because this business will give you surprises. And, you know, if you're expecting a cash flow of $500 a month and a water heater breaks and it went from 500 positive to negative 300, you don't want your significant other to say, rah, 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 I told you this wasn't a good thing. And, you know, it just tears you down. You've got to have the support of the people closest to you. So have those discussions up front, because you're not, you know, in my case, not only taking a lot of capital and put it to work that could do other things,
sure,
but we're taking time, mm-hmm, right? We have time that we put to this that we could be doing other things. And if you're not both fully, fully committed, I would tell you, you're probably asking for trouble. So that's one thing that I didn't think we covered that I think Lawrence mentioned.
Yeah, that's really good advice. In my case, it's kind of like yours, where me and my wife work together on it and she's supportive of it. What would you say to somebody who doesn't have a supportive spouse, partner, whatever? How can they get that support?
It's tough, right? You've got to sit them down, have a conversation. I think you've got to talk to them about why a little sacrifice today, especially in a market like this, right? This market isn't 2006 and everybody's, you know, who can fog a mirror is getting loan. Stuff's on sale.
Yeah.
And when stuff's on sale, you should go buying, right? Buy when everybody's afraid.
That's right.
To Buffett. But you've got to sit them down and talk about how just taking a little sliver of time or capital or something and putting it to work for the future should be of interest. And if they're not on board, walking through houses, you know, show them the reports that we're writing up. Have them watch the radio shows. You've got to get that individual who's on the fence or negative to see that there are people being successful, because that's usually what happens when somebody's negative, is they had a friend of a friend who lost a house, or they read a story about so-and-so who got kicked out. And it's all true, but it doesn't have to be that way.
Right.
You know, so help get them comfortable by sharing other investors' success stories, whether it be listening to the programs or, you know, reading reports or whatever. So that's, you know, and if they're not on board, I don't know. That's tough.
maybe not do it. I mean, what you're saying is, if there's not harmony there and you're not working together on it, it may not be worth doing. It would be.
I can tell you two things. You will have surprises, good and bad.
Yeah.
The bad ones will lead to fights, and you may not want to add that added stress to your relationship.
Right.
You know, one guy's opinion.
Good point. Good point. So, one last question, if I might. I just remembered what it was. You mentioned on your website where you're writing up the acquisition reports, kind of what happened and lessons learned. What's one of the more interesting lessons learned that you've had in these years of investing in real estate?
Lessons learned. Interesting. Okay. There's so many. I mean, every house I learned two or three things. I guess the one is don't always trust what's in the MLS is interesting. I remember there was a house that was written up cleanest, because I'm not an agent, right? I'm just Joe Blow investor guy who goes into a local MLS site that an agent does. So I don't have any special access.
Right.
And it said two bedroom, one bath, one car garage, but it said 1,500 square feet. And in my market, you know, a 2-1, you know, they were built, there's a lot of them, but they were 700, 850 square feet, maybe 900.
Right.
1,500 square feet. I'm like, and priced okay. I mean, it was asking like 52 grand, something like that. And so I said, there's got to be something. So that immediately went on my list. You know, we went down the weekend. I always have a list of stuff we see. And it was a 4-bedroom, 2-bath house, 2-car garage.
Wow.
So maybe it was added on without permits, probably. I don't know. But it looked of quality like you would see in the Bay Area, right? Stuccoed house, the whole bit.
Wow. For $52,000?
I bought it for 41. I offered 40 and came up to 41, right? Listed at 52.
Right.
So, and it rents for 10.50.
So. Oh, my goodness. So that turned out, if you had just trusted the MLS, you would have never looked at it.
Would have never even looked at it. 52 yeah. grand for a 2-bedroom in my market, rent for 7.50.
Yeah.
You know, a 4.2 rents for 10.50. So...
That is so interesting. Wow, that's just amazing. You know, I had just last week I had an experience, same lesson learned, but opposite, which was
it does happen.
Yeah, the house looked really good price and everything, but it said it was a 3-bedroom, 2-bath, 2-car garage, single family house. And at least here in Houston, sometimes I'll make an offer without going and looking at the property. Well, this one, we got our offer accepted. Everything looked great, and I went to go do the inspection the day after, and it turned out that it was a zero lot line house, which is kind of like a duplex. So,
it was only shared wall.
Yeah, shared wall, and there was no garage.
Oh, hello.
It's like, I'm sorry, you guys. I don't back out of contracts once they're accepted, right. But the listing was wrong.
Yeah, one of us was wrong here, and it wasn't me.
That's right. Oh, boy. So good lesson learned. Good lesson learned. Don't always trust the MLS.
Either way.
That's right. Oh, boy. Well, thank you, Mike. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm going to get back in touch with you after the interview. There's a few other things I want to talk to you about. But thank you so much for spending time today, and we'll have this interview up in a couple weeks. We have to get it transcribed and everything, and that takes a little bit of time. So
no problem.
Great.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much. See you later.
Take care.
Bye-bye. Awesome.